some of the ways in which a worker co-op-based economy will change the larger society to reinforce its ability to serve the people that the democratization of workplaces is intended to rescue from the condition they suffer in capitalism. I hope you have found this extended discussion useful, particularly those of you who wanted to hear some more about the larger context. The focus on worker co-ops is a response to the fact that the old criticisms of capitalism, the older socialisms, talked about all kinds of important, interesting things, but they tended to neglect the transformations inside the workplace that were needed to make a transition from capitalism to something better happen. That's why we focus on it, but it's an addition to the issues of the larger society, not a substitute. Thank you very much for your attention. We've come to the end. Appreciate your being interested, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
The Pacifica Bylaws referendum is underway. February 18th is the start of the balloting phase, and all valid members will receive an e-ballot, paper ballot, or postcard with unique voter ID and PIN to cast your vote in favor of or against the proposed bylaws. For more information or to contact the election supervisor, visit elections.pacifica.org or leave a voicemail on 510-931-7504. All ballots must be received by March 19, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in order to be counted. The proposed bylaws will reduce the size of the Pacifica National Board from 23 to 11. Proponents state that there are too many cooks in the kitchen, creating chaos. Opponents state that smaller boards means fewer voices and less representation.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Economic Update, which is heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News, usually at 7 p.m. You'll be hearing Off the Hook. They are preempted, and they'll be back on the air next week at its regular time. As you know, we are in fundraising mode, and for those people that are listening to the very first time to this radio station, we are in fundraising mode. And the reason why we're in fundraising mode is because we do not take corporate sponsorship from in order to sustain this radio station. We do not take endowments. We do not take gifts from oligarchs. We get from fully and clearly from the listeners like you. And so if you appreciate what we try to bring to the table on a daily basis here for 60 years, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 516-620-3602. That number again is 516-620-3602, or go to give to WBAI.org online. And you can do that while the show is on the air as we speak. With that said, we're about to go into the next program. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry. China continues to face massive travel restrictions, house-to-house checks, huge isolation wards, and lockdowns of entire cities. Outbreaks are emerging in Italy, South Korea, and Iran, and all across the Middle East. Meanwhile, Donald Trump and U.S. officials are sending mixed messages on the virus risk here. Trump and his top economic advisors say coronavirus is under control in the U.S., But Dr. Nancy Meissonier of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness. The message from U.S. health officials has become more urgent as they work to educate Americans about the risk and what would happen if quarantining travelers is not enough to contain the virus. This was an issue discussed at the Democratic presidential debate in Charleston, South Carolina, in advance of Super Tuesday. That's where concerns about containing the spread of the coronavirus and funding for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were front and center. Here's Gail King with CBS's question last night about coronavirus at the debate.
Well, Senator Klobuchar, as we were coming over today, there was breaking news from the CDC about the coronavirus. And so far, there have been 2,700 deaths globally. And so far in this country, there have been no deaths. But the CDC says this: it's not a matter of if the virus will spread here, but when. The question to you is this: would you close the borders to Americans who have been exposed to the coronavirus in order to prevent an outbreak here in this country?
Well, what we have to do is make sure that we have treatment for those Americans and that they are in a quarantine situation. We don't want to expose people, but we want to give them help. And I would agree when Mayor Bloomberg said that this president has not invested like he should have in his budget. He tried to cut back on the CDC. He tried to cut back on the international organization that would coordinate with the rest of the world. He hasn't yet really addressed the nation on this topic. I would do all of that. But I want to take this out of politics right now and talk to the American people, because this is so serious. I'm not going to give my website right now. I'm going to give the CDC's website, which is cdc.gov, so that people keep checking in and they follow the rules and they realize what they have to do if they feel sick and they call their health care provider. Because many doctors are saying it's just a matter of time before we're going to start seeing this here. And I think the answers as president, what would I do? I would better coordinate throughout my presidency to be ready for the next pandemic and to prepare for this one. I would have better relations with our allies, and I would support, because I know the vaccine is out there in the head of some kid right now in school in Columbia, South Carolina, or Houston, Texas, and it's investing in education so we are ready to lead again in the world.
Mr. Vice President, we reached a turning point today with the CDC warning schools that they must prepare, that they might have to close. Members of the Trump administration saying we don't have enough medical masks if necessary. What would you do?
What we did with Ebola, I was part of making sure that pandemic did not get to the United States, saved millions of lives. And what we did, we set up, I helped set up that office in the presidency, in the president's office on diseases that are pandemic diseases. We increased the budget of the CDC. We increased the NIH budget. We should, if I'm president today, and he's wiped all that out. We did it. We stopped it. And the second thing I'd point out to you is that what I would do immediately is restore the funding. He cut the funding for CDC. He tried to cut the funding for NIH. He cut the funding for the entire effort. And here's the deal. I would be on the phone with China and making it clear. We are going to need to be in your country. You have to be open. You have to be clear. We have to know what's going on. We have to be there with you and insist on it and insist. I could get that done. No one up here has ever dealt internationally with any of these world leaders. I'm the only one that has.
Senator Sanders.
In the White House today, we have a self-described great genius. Self-described. And this great genius has told us that this coronavirus is going to end in 2 months. April is the magical day that this great scientist we have in the White House has determined. I wish I was kidding. That is what he said. What do we have to do? Whether or not the issue is climate change, which is clearly a global crisis requiring international cooperation, or infectious diseases like coronavirus requiring international cooperation, We have to work and expand the World Health Organization. Obviously, we have to make sure the CDC, the NIH, our infectious departments are fully funded. This is a global problem. We've got to work with countries all over the world to solve it.
From the Democratic presidential debate in Charleston, South Carolina on Tuesday night. This is WBAI in New York. And on Tuesday, U.S. health officials held a news briefing on the coronavirus outbreak.
This is the HHS briefing on the China coronavirus with an update on the risk presented by the virus.
Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, followed by Dr. Ann Shukat, Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, gave a news conference about the U.S. preparedness or lack of preparedness regarding the coronavirus. We first go to Alex Azar.
I'm joined today by Dr. Ann Shukat, the Principal Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Dr. Tony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Dr. Robert Kadlec, HHS's Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, and Dr. Stephen Hahn, the Commissioner of Food and Drugs. As of this morning, we still have only 14 cases of the China coronavirus detected here in the United States involving travel to China or close contacts with those travelers. We have 3 cases among Americans repatriated from Wuhan, and we have 40 cases among American passengers repatriated from the Diamond Princess in Japan. I want to thank the responders and communities that have worked with HHS and the administration to provide these Americans with the treatment they need. I'm also grateful to the governors and other state and local leaders who have worked with us in close partnership so far. The immediate risk to the general American public remains low. But as we have warned, that has the potential to change quickly. There is now community transmission in a number of countries, including outside of Asia. That's deeply concerning, and community spread in other countries will make successful containment at our borders harder and harder. That's why we've already been working closely with state, local, and private sector partners to prepare for mitigating the virus's potential spread in the United States, because we will likely see more cases here, as we have said throughout this episode. Dr. Shukat will provide some more details on what that will look like, including how we would treat potential cases that arise from community transmission here in the United States. This preparation has been possible in part because of how aggressively President Trump has responded to this outbreak. As soon as we knew of the threat presented by this novel virus, public health leaders were monitoring it and beginning to prepare. The travel restrictions that the president put in place at the beginning of this month have given our country valuable time to continue to prepare, and that is precisely what those measures were designed to do. That includes working with Congress. Yesterday, the White House sent a request to Congress to make at least $2.5 billion in funding available for preparedness and response. There are 5 major priorities within the supplemental request, which I underscored this morning before the Senate Appropriations Committee. First, we need to expand our surveillance work, building on an existing system we have within CDC's influenza surveillance network. Second, we will need funds to support public health preparedness and response for state and local governments for what could be a very large-scale response. We don't know, but we must prepare for that just in case. This support complements the significant funds that these partners have received from CDC for preparedness, about 2/3 of $1 billion a year in recent years. Third and fourth, we need to support the development of therapeutics and the development of vaccines. Given the scale of this outbreak, the private sector sees a real market for both kinds of countermeasures, as well as for diagnostics, but federal funding and guidance can accelerate this work. Dr. Fauci will address the current status of that work in more depth. Fifth and finally, we need funds for the purchase of personal protective equipment for the Strategic National Stockpile, a topic that Dr. Kadlec can address. I'll conclude by noting that Though scheduling conflicts prevented this briefing from including other members of the president's coronavirus task force, we'll be providing a new update from interagency leaders soon, and we expect to continue doing so regularly. Earlier this afternoon on CNBC, the National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow offered an update on how we see this outbreak affecting the economy. This morning, Dr. Messonnier from CDC provided the usual telebriefing. As Dr. Shuchat will emphasize in just a moment, the Trump administration will continue to be aggressively transparent as the outbreak and our response evolve. We'll continue keeping the American people and the media apprised of the situation, as well as what everyone can do to prepare. In the meantime, I'll continue to work closely with President Trump and the President's task force on our preparations to keep Americans safe. With that, I'll hand things over to Dr. Shuchat for an update from the CDC. Dr. Shuchat?
Thank you. Well, thanks so much. I'd like to start out by saying it's a difficult and uncertain time. We, along with our partners around the country and around the world, have been confronting a dynamic, rapidly evolving situation. I'd like to let Americans know that CDC and our nation's public health agencies are preparing every day for this type of situation. Preparedness started long before this outbreak. The U.S. government's response to the spread of the novel coronavirus into our country began as soon as reports of an unidentified flu-like illness emerged from Wuhan, China. The U.S. has been implementing an aggressive containment strategy that requires detecting, tracking, and isolating all cases as much as possible and preventing more introductions of disease, notably at ports of entry. We've restricted travel into the U.S. and have issued multiple travel advisories for countries currently experiencing community spread. Our travel notices are changing almost daily as we get new information. And we believe those precautions are working. So far, as Secretary Azar described, our public health system has detected 14 cases in travelers or very close contacts of travelers here in the United States. Among passengers repatriated from by the State Department from Wuhan, China, and from the Diamond Princess, there are an additional 340 cases. The fact that we have been able to keep cases to this low level is an accomplishment, especially given that we are, unfortunately, beginning to see community spread in a growing number of other countries. Based on what we know right now, we believe the immediate risk here in the United States remains low, and we're working hard to keep that risk low. But we must use this time to continue to prepare for the event of community transmission in the United States. Part of that preparation is educating the public and our state, local, and private sector partners about what transition from aggressive containment measures to community measures or community mitigation would look like should we end up there. Under our current aggressive containment posture, patients infected with the coronavirus who have mild or no symptoms are being placed in healthcare facilities for very close observation and isolation. That intensive level of medical care is not typically needed. As we've watched these cases and learned over the past several weeks, we realize that other approaches to management are likely fine. Outside this period of aggressive containment, the usual and appropriate care for most patients who develop the novel coronavirus or COVID-19 would be management at home through home isolation, with use of healthcare facilities only as needed for those who have severe presentations, the elderly, those with medical conditions requiring closer observation. We will maintain for as long as practical a dual approach where we continue these measures of aggressive containment to this disease, but also employ strategies to minimize the impact on our communities. However, current global circumstances suggest it's likely that this virus will cause a pandemic. In that case, risk assessment would be different, and new strategies tailored to local circumstances would need to be implemented to blunt the impact of the disease and further slow the spread of the virus. What these interventions would look like at the community level will vary depending on local conditions and on the emerging information about how severe the virus may be. Now, it's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will become infected and how many of those will develop severe or more complicated disease. We have been preparing to address this type of threat and limit the impact on our communities for many years. As some of you heard from Dr. Meissonier of the CDC today, we've begun laying out for the public what it will look like to mitigate the spread of the virus. There are obvious common sense tools like good hygiene, social distancing, things like staying home when you're sick, things we talk about during a difficult flu season, or things that we talked about during the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. We will be transparent with the public about these measures and the potential that these tools will be necessary. There is literally a playbook for the use of these tools, and one that the states and local public health have exercised. We are committed at the CDC and across HHS and the U.S. government to radical transparency, to making sure we're sharing what we know when we know it, and we're giving you a sense of what the future may hold. I'd like to now turn things over to Dr. Fauci for his update.
Thank you very much, Anne. I'm going to give you a very brief update on the countermeasure development that I introduced to this audience on a number of occasions over the past couple of weeks. And the first regarding the issue of vaccine. You might recall that I had mentioned when we first introduced the topic of vaccine that very shortly after the sequence was put on a public database, we began a vaccine development program, which was one of several supported both by the NIH as well as BARDA from ASPR, and even independent individuals that we have been involved in collaborating with for a period of time. One of these vaccines, I think, serves as the prototype of the timing of what we were talking about. You might recall I had mentioned that from the time we had available sequence, we would hope to be in clinical trials within 2 to 3 months. And I said, barring any glitches, that would be the fastest ever in any vaccine that we've gone from the identification of a pathogen to putting it into a human in a phase one trial. Well, I'm happy to report to you this afternoon that we are on time at least and maybe even a little better. The gene has been expressed in the platform, in this case, a messenger RNA. The material has been produced. It's been put into mice. It's immunogenic. And it's now getting ready to go through the regulatory issues of getting it to go. So I would project that we would be in a human trial, I would say, within a month and a half. And I had thought that maybe cut a week or so off. Again, hopefully, no further glitches. Now, the thing we need to understand, because we want to make sure people don't get confused, that getting a vaccine into a phase one trial within a three-month period, you need at least 3 to 4 months to determine if it's safe and whether it induces the kind of response that you would predict would be protective. Once you do that, you graduate to a much larger trial. The N of the number of people in the phase one trial is 45. When you go to a phase two trial, you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands of individuals to determine efficacy. That is a trial that we would have to conduct in those countries and those areas where there's active transmission. That itself, even at rocket speed, would take at least an additional 6 to 8 months. So when you're talking about the availability of a vaccine, even to scale it up, you're talking about a year to a year and a half. Now, you shouldn't be discouraged by that, because it is certainly conceivable that this issue with this coronavirus will go well beyond this season into next season. So a vaccine may not solve the problems of the next couple of months, but it certainly would be an important tool that we would have, and we'll keep you posted on that. Secondly, and finally, the issue of therapeutic interventions. There are a number of candidates that we are now looking at that have shown some suggestion, either in vitro, in an animal model, or some empiric trials that were done during the MERS outbreak. One of these, and there are several that we're considering, is called remdesivir, which is a nucleotide analog that is produced by Gilead. Today, as I speak, there are two major clinical trials going on in China, which are randomized controlled trials, which means that we will get an answer whether or not it works or doesn't work, I think, within a reasonable period of time. An identical copy of that trial is now being implemented in Nebraska with our colleagues who are taking care of the individuals who were taken from the Diamond Princess and brought back here, in addition to our colleagues in Japan. So I'm optimistic that we will at least get an answer. If we do have a therapy, that really is a game changer, because then we could do something from the standpoint of intervention for those who are sick. So hopefully I'll get the opportunity in the future to continue to update on these interventions. Thank you. I'd like to introduce Dr. Catlett.
Dr. Fauci, thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. ASPR is providing unprecedented operational and logistical support to the State Department to repatriate approximately 1,100 Americans from China and from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in Japan. We are pleased that the passengers evacuated from China have completed their 14-day quarantine and have returned to their homes and families safely. Passengers evacuated from the Diamond Princess are in the process of completing their 14-day quarantine at two DOD installations, one in California and one in Texas. Medical professionals from our National Disaster Medical System and CDC are continually monitoring the health of these passengers. Any passengers who show signs of any illness are moved off the DOD facility and tested for this virus. Passengers who are tested positive for this coronavirus cannot stay on the military installations, and these patients are being transported safely to our network of special pathogen treatment centers, such as the University of Nebraska Medical Center, as part of our aggressive containment posture. These individuals are being placed in these facilities for quarantine and isolation purposes only. An intensive level of medical care is not typically needed by most of these individuals. At these centers, the patients who develop this infection can participate in the clinical trial that Dr. Fauci described with remdesivir. We are honored to have helped NIH to arrange that clinical trial within this special network of treatment centers. In addition, our Biomedical Advanced Research Development Authority, BARDA, is working with Regeneron to develop two possible treatments, and with Janssen and Johnson & Johnson to screen existing and investigational treatments in compounds to identify any that have potential use in treating coronavirus, and with Janssen and Sanofi to develop vaccines using vaccine technology that the HHS supported for pandemic influenza vaccines. We're reviewing hundreds of proposals for additional therapeutics and vaccines, and in particular diagnostics that can be used in hospital and clinical labs or doctor's offices. We're also prepared to support CDC and Department of Homeland Security at designated military installations where Americans returning to the U.S. on commercial flights can be quarantined based on their travel history. The most recent location to receive such a traveler is the naval base at Ventura County, Point Mugu, where one American is currently completing quarantine. Any quarantine at any of these military installations would not have any symptoms or positive test result. Quarantine is based solely on their travel history that places them at high risk for possible exposure. Their health is continually monitored, and they're transferred safely to medical facilities for testing and treatment if any symptoms develop. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Stephen Hahn from the FDA.
Thank you, Dr. Catalick. And thank you for the opportunity to update you today on FDA's coronavirus activities. The FDA plays an essential role in overseeing our nation's medical products as part of our vital mission to protect and promote public health, including during public health emergencies. The FDA is an active partner in the novel coronavirus response, working closely with our government and public health partners across the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as our international counterparts. Our work is multifaceted, focusing on actively facilitating efforts to diagnose, treat, and prevent the disease, surveilling the medical product supply chain for potential shortages or disruptions, and helping to mitigate such impacts as necessary, and leveraging the full breadth of our public health tools as we oversee the safety and quality of FDA-regulated products for American patients and consumers. I'm happy to answer questions about FDA's activities, but I'll provide a few updates. First of all, the supply chain. FDA is keenly aware that the outbreak will likely affect the medical product supply chain, including potential disruptions to supplier shortages of critical medical products in the U.S. We are proactively reaching out to hundreds of medical product manufacturers to gather information about the supply chain. First, it's important to note that FDA is not aware of any medical product shortages at this time. We are, however, monitoring several products that might be at risk, particularly personal protective equipment, but we do not have any manufacturer shortages to report. Please be assured, if a potential shortage or disruption of medical products is identified by the FDA, we will use all of our available tools to react swiftly and mitigate the impact to U.S. patients and healthcare professionals. And we will take steps to quickly share that information with the public. With respect to inspections, for February and March, FDA has identified approximately 100 scheduled inspections in China, the vast majority of which are routine surveillance inspections. Those inspections are just postponed at this time and will be conducted at a later date. It's important to remember that these delayed routine surveillance inspections can happen at any time during the year. And while inspections in China are delayed secondary to the State Department travel advisory, we will send investigators to other parts of the world to ensure we are on schedule for our planned inspections for the year. Also would like to remind everyone that the inspections are just one tool that FDA can use to monitor compliance and to help prevent products that do not meet FDA standards for entering the U.S. marketplace. This process has a number of layers in place and is not solely reliant on boots-on-the-ground inspections. Overall, this remains an evolving and very dynamic issue that we will vigilantly monitor. We are committed to continuing to communicate with the public as we have further updates. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hahn. At this point, why don't we open it up for questions? Yes? Here. If you could just wait for the microphone so the TV cameras can hear your question.
Thank you, Secretary Arthur. I'm Olivia Zhang with China's Taishin Media. My first question is, as China's coronavirus cases seems to be contained, while there are other countries like Italy, Japan, or South Korea seems expanding, I wonder, are you considering loosen the travel restrictions regarding foreigners with travel history from China while considering imposing travel restrictions with, you know, travel histories regarding the above three countries? And also, I noticed that you were still referring the COVID-19 as China coronavirus. Well, I think I think WTO changed this to COVID-19 because they think the China coronavirus might lead to like xenophobia or racism. Do you think it's proper to still like refer it to China coronavirus? Thanks.
So we intend to keep our travel restrictions with regard to China in place at the moment. The virus is still spreading in China. We're still having hundreds of case reports per day. If that's capturing all of the information, we're still seeing dozens or more fatalities reported per day. We certainly hope that China is able to engage in effective containment measures to slow the spread of this virus down, but there's nothing at this point that would indicate a change in our posture towards our aggressive containment measures with regard to travel in China. It's important, though, to remember we've been very moderated and titrated in those travel measures. They simply are based on 14 days, which is the maximum predicted incubation period. And so an individual who has been in China for the previous 14 days, who is a foreign national, would not be permitted to enter the United States, and an American or permanent resident would be permitted to return to the United States, of course, but asked to home isolate during the completion of a 14-day period outside of China. That is not a ban. That is a temporary restriction in line with the public health measures that we're taking. So we've tried to be very respectful towards travel. And, of course, those restrictions are not based on other than American and permanent resident versus non-Americans, really as a matter of focusing our resources. They're not based on the ethnicity of an individual or anything else, because, as you mentioned, it is important that we not engage in any that people not believe that because of somebody's ethnicity, they're more likely to have this disease or not. Our criteria are all based on travel in affected areas and warning people about travel in infected areas based on the epidemiology and the evidence. So, Brianna, did you have her? Yes.
So thank you, Secretary Azar. So the CDC said this morning that Americans should prepare for their everyday lives to potentially be disrupted by the inevitable spread of the coronavirus in the U.S. Your comments haven't gone quite as far, and the president also tweeted that everything is under control. Can you address the difference in messaging? And then secondly, given what you know now, are you expecting community spread in the U.S. in the near future? And how confident are you that the U.S. is prepared to respond?
Okay. Let me ask Dr. Shukat if she could speak to the CDC's discussion this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think Dr. Missonnier talked about the potential for community transmission and helping Americans think about what that would mean. I think to help Americans frame what to expect, it's helpful to think about a bad flu year or even the 2009 pandemic, where in different locations at different times, the circumstances required different measures. The idea of exactly what that will look like in the United States is hard to say. And of course, the images we've been seeing from China, from Hubei province are quite different from what we would expect in the U.S. context. So I think what's really important for people is to stay informed, stay aware, and to learn about the circumstances. We really think everyday measures like covering your cough or sneeze, staying home when you're sick, are very important. And of course, the evergreen, wash your hands. We do know that at the beginning of the H1N1 pandemic, schools were closed. That's one of those social distancing community mitigation tools. Well, schools were closed briefly until we learned more about the virus and what to expect. And we realized that the trade-off between the disruption of school closures and the benefit of school closures for that particular virus, the equation suggested we didn't need to do that. And instead, we moved to a message of children staying home when they were sick. So I think Dr. Missonnier's comments were really to frame what might happen in the future. It's very important to say that our efforts at containment so far have worked, and the virus is actually contained here in the United States. We don't want to delay thinking about other possibilities, and it was really an educational moment that she talked about.
You've been listening to a news conference presented by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention earlier today on the coronavirus outbreak. You heard Alex Azar, Donald Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Ann Shukat, Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and Dr. Robert Catlick with Health and Human Services, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, and Dr. Stephen Hahn with the Food and Drug Administration. This is listener-sponsored WBAI in New York.
Time you are overwhelmed, cytokines, these inflammatory agents, and only then do you get a fever that is largely due to the body fighting back. And that's when they measure your forehead and say, oh, your temperature's up, so therefore you could be infected. Then they do further testing. But there's an incubation period where you're shedding, you're breathing, you're touching surfaces, you touch your nose, you touch your mouth, touch your eyes. These are the entry points. And now every place that you've touched, it can stay for up to 9 days on that surface area. And so I'm very concerned. They did not quarantine the people on the ship. So that meant that if you've ever been on a cruise ship, Michael G.,
Gary, no, I haven't been. Actually, I was on a cruise ship some time ago, and it's like a petri dish of possible infectious diseases all around.
You are correct. I did a health cruise. The Queen Elizabeth asked me, would I come on and do a cruise, a two-week cruise with them? And they were nice people, and it was a really nice group of people, and we spent 2 weeks together. I was supposed to give a two-hour lecture each day, right? Well, I ended up doing about 14 hours of lecture a day because they didn't have a whole lot of other things they were interested in except their health. So I was going table to table during dinners, talking with people. It was a nice group of people. It was a lot of people. And I was glad when it was over. I can tell you that. I just went back and just fell into bed and slept. In any case, they feed you nonstop. I mean, all day long and all night they're feeding you. And people keep queuing up to these food tables. But they're out in the open. And then you go to the different concerts, which are generally good, entertaining. But you're exposed to 1,000, 1,500 people in one room into their big banquet rooms. And you'll hear people coughing and sneezing. You think, well, they're 20 feet away. It doesn't matter. It does matter. In fact, when you talk loud, just loud, you can throw water droplets from your mouth 50 feet out into the air. Now imagine everyone, the whole room, as you said, is a petri dish. What if one of those people have a particular infection, any kind of bacterial infection in their lungs? Maybe they have a non-productive dry cough. They're coughing all the time, but they're shedding, and they're shedding viral materials. So that's why I'm very concerned. So what I've done is I've done two things today. First, for everyone, I want to just give you a little background of what you can do to help protect yourself. First and foremost, just proper hygiene. In your house, have a bottle, a spray, just a, you know, one of the little containers you can spray and fill it with isopropyl, just rubbing alcohol. And you spray your doorknob, spray your refrigerator handles and your faucet handles, your toilet handles, every door in the house, spray your keyboard, spray your telephone, and then wipe it down. It is the wiping down that causes the viral bacteria, the envelope around it to become shattered. So it's just not spraying it, it's rubbing it. And then just if someone's sick, have them use paper, not regular utensils, because you don't have autoclave equipment. You're not going to get that water up hot at 700 degrees. You're just not going to do it. So if you can't sterilize something, then you could become infected. Now, remember, restaurants have dishwashers. Some do, some don't. But a lot don't, in which case then you could be having a glass and you could pick up herpes from that glass of water. People have no idea how contaminated things really are. I'm not asking people to live in a bubble. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting we have to be smarter and not cavalier going forward. So hygiene is important. It's just like, you know, I'm not saying this to gross anyone, but as a nation, we're wipers, not washers. It's interesting. You go to other countries and you'll see bidets in the bathroom. You know, they will do their business, then they soap and water, and they're cleaning themselves. Right. But if you don't, those bacteria migrate, and these are very toxic bacteria, like E. coli, from there down into the genitalia, and that's how millions of Americans get urinary tract infections, because They go in through the urethra into the bladder. And then we have all this, you know, cost and pain and time to deal with it when if we just washed ourselves. But we're not terribly hygienic. And people with beards and mustaches are extremely unhygienic because even if they take a shower, once they defecate and once they wipe themselves, they forget and they stroke their beard or mustache. And we touch our mouth about 250 times per day. So in effect, we're infecting ourselves, reinfecting ourselves. We don't clean our toothbrush. We should put it upside down in some hydrogen peroxide. Because if we don't, and we've had a cold or flu, or we have some form of a virus or bacteria, every time we go to brush our teeth, we're reinfecting ourselves. Same way with our telephone. That's why if you're infected, yeah, every time you use the phone, you have to take alcohol. Just a simple little process. Spritz it on the phone and wipe it down. Same way with your keyboard. And most keyboards are loaded with pathogenic bacteria and viruses. Simple things, not expensive, easy to do. Now, the coronavirus is an enveloped single-stranded RNA virus belonging to the coronaviridae family. And the coronavirus causes upper respiratory tract and gastrointestinal infections in mammals and birds. In humans, it mainly causes the common cold, but complications, including pneumonia, can occur and do. And most reported deaths from current coronavirus pandemics seem to be associated with subsequent pneumonia infections and severe coronavirus strains leading to acute respiratory syndrome, such as, well, we've had in the past, the Chinese SARS, S-A-R-S, outbreak in 2003, and the MERS, M-E-R-S, or the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome that killed many in the Middle East. So what can you do? Well, a couple things. First, let's do the easy thing. There's an article in the peer-reviewed journal Arthromolecular News from January 2020, just a month ago, based on 30 clinical studies confirming the antiviral activity of vitamin C. Now, most studies on vitamin C and viruses focus upon influenza, but there is some evidence that every virus responds in some way to vitamin C treatment, either by mega oral doses, like 10,000 milligrams a day, or intravenous, 100,000 to 150,000 daily. Now, the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine study recommended IV vitamin C for coronavirus and rhinovirus and enterovirus. Now, there's a meta, which means many different studies looking for similarities. They analyzed this mega dose of vitamin C, confirming that daily supplementation significantly lessened duration of the common cold. Often coronavirus in 9 randomized controlled studies. Then vitamin D3. Now, this is particularly important for people of color because if a light complexion person goes in the sun, a moderate complexion and a dark complexion person, the one that will receive the most vitamin C is the light complexion because it's converted by sunlight in the skin. And the one receiving the least amount of vitamin D would be the darker skin because the melanin blocks this. So therefore, I suggest supplementing, actually taking vitamin D3, 10,000 units a day to establish normal vitamin D levels. And there's a Dr. John Cannell, C-A-N-N-E-L. He recommends 50,000 units a day for 5 days, then reduce it to 5,000 daily to maintain healthy levels. And the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, March 2010, a double-blind, placebo-controlled study for warding off flu and flu-like viruses during cold season showed a 58% reduced risk when you're using vitamin D. Columbia University Medical Center, they did a randomized trial of monthly vitamin D, significantly prevented respiratory cold complications in children. St. Michael's Hospital in the University of Chicago, high-dose vitamin D, necessary in the winter months to prevent respiratory tract infections that include the coronavirus. But a real powerful, I mean super powerful, impact against all viruses, and you can read this in the Journal of Nanotechnology, October 2005, the study by the University of Texas and the Mexico University, concluded that silver nanoparticle kills HIV-1 within 3 hours and virtually any other virus. And there was a large study by Japan's National Defense Medical College Research Institute that published in the Journal of Molecular Sciences recommended Japanese healthcare workers take nano-silver to protect themselves from viruses such as the coronavirus. And then a couple teaspoons per day. Let's say I would suggest most people would take 10 to 20 parts per million. I would suggest 500 parts per million, one teaspoon per day. And here's how silver works. Silver, in the form we're talking about, colloidal silver, binds to membranes of viruses to limit its oxygen supply and essentially suffocates it. It binds to the virus's DNA to prevent it from multiplying. So that's another thing you can do. Then there's the old wise elderberry. There's a large body of studies showing its inhibitory effects on influenza and other flu-like viruses. Also, for lessening the duration of colds and respiratory infections, from Griffith University in Australia, there's a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. Hebrew University Medical School, quote, elderberry extract seems to offer an efficient, safe, and cost-effective treatment for influenza. And Emory University and Johns Hopkins University says that it inhibited infectious bronchitis virus, including coronavirus, at early point during viral replication. And finally, astragalus, astragalus, one of the most thoroughly studied herbs in all of history, strongly antiviral and antibacterial, and it is a standard medical herb used in traditional Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine, mainly for fighting infections. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Avian Disease and Oncology Laboratory found it inhibits avian flu viruses. And a study was replicated in Jilin Institute of Animal Sciences in China. In Shanghai Medical University, showed that the Coxsackie virus, another flu-like respiratory infection, is inhibited by astragalus. And then Manipal University in India, it's effective against the coronavirus, adenovirus, herpes, rhinovirus, parainfluenza.
The daughters of Ilyadad.
I would also add in olive leaf
extract.
And these studies have shown it's effective against the cold and flu viruses, meningitis, pneumonia, which is the co-infection being seen in recent coronavirus deaths, hepatitis B, gonorrhea, and tuberculosis. And New York University School of Medicine study, olive leaf extracts reversed HIV-1 infections and published an article in the Journal of Biochemical and Biophysical Research. There's the University of Auckland in New Zealand studied olive leaf extracts' ability to treat respiratory illness, including coronavirus, in randomized trials. Now, there are other things you can do. There are herbs targeting SARS-related coronaviruses, and there's a lot of that. But I just wanted to share that. And, of course, if you're infected, I recommend ozone, absolutely. So those are the things I would start with. Those are things we can do that are not expensive. And then there is the superstar. And for that, I'm going to introduce you once again to Dr. Roy Spicer. Dr. Spicer got his PhD in immunology bacteriology from Rutgers University. He is a specialist in waterborne and infectious conditions, and he is studying the mini ionic filter. This is what I travel with everywhere. If you come to my lectures, I'm generally wearing dark because this little ionic filter is about 2 inches long, light, like an ounce or two, and nobody knows I'm wearing it. But I'm wearing that because it's throwing off a protective barrier around my head, because for every lecture, Michael G., as you know, I do for 2 hours, I generally wait 2 to 3 hours
afterwards,
answering people's
right.
questions.
Right, that's right.
So they're right up in my face. I don't know what kind of infection mm-hmm. you have mm-hmm. because a lot of times they're shedding, especially after they've gotten a flu vaccine. They're shedding for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And even the coronavirus, there are other viruses you could have. They may not even be at the advanced infectious stage, so they wouldn't be manifesting the symptoms, but they're talking, and just talking, you can throw the virus and bacteria right in someone's face. So I want to show you what I believe would be a way to help you with all forms of bacteria and different viruses and dust and molds and danders from getting into your mouth and your nose. And by the way, every time I'm on an airplane, you bet I wear this. In fact, there was once where a flight attendant says, "What's that?" And I said, "This is just a little ionic." "Well, we don't allow that." I said, "Of course you do. I wear it all the time." "Well, I don't know about it. I left the plane. I'm not about to fly. It's a petri dish."
Well, yeah.
The air in every plane is polluted. I wear it to movies. I wear it in elevators. I wear it when I lecture. I wear it in a cab. I don't know who's been in that cab and coughing, and that is all still in the air. I'm not being paranoid, and that's why I've never been sick. Okay? Ask yourself, when was the last time you heard I was sick? When was the last time I couldn't do a radio show? The only thing that happens is I do so much lecturing, so much counseling every day, 7 days a week, that my voice gets a little strained. But no, you don't see me in bed or in a hospital with some disease. And that's not because I'm immune. I'm not. That's not because, you know, I have some way of handling it. I don't. I'm just as vulnerable as anyone else. I just take precautions. I believe in the precautionary principle. Let's say hello to Dr. Roy Spicer.
And hi, as we say hello to Dr. Spicer, I just want to let the listeners know, Gary, that we have a fantastic offer that we're going to talk about just after you hear from Dr. Spicer. So I want you to stand by and remember our number, 516-620-3602. Stand by. You'll listen to Dr. Spicer. You'll hear Gary. And then we'll be offering this to you for a pledge of support, supporting this radio station WBAI. Dr. Spicer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Hi, Roy. Just to do a classroom on the air, let's assume that people do not know the power of viruses and bacteria and molds and other airborne particulate matter and what happens when it gets into our body and how it can manifest. And we're not talking about the coronavirus. We're talking about all different types of things we're exposed to and what we can do preventatively, and then the mechanisms, the proof, the scientific studies, the university studies on the Minic Ionic. The form is yours. Take your time. We have no rushing here.
Well, first, Gary, you covered a lot of information on how to protect yourself generally, you know, from infectious diseases that are commonly in the air and on surfaces. I studied this microbiology when I was in the Department of Health in New Jersey, and I saw firsthand when people came back from traveling around the world, even in the United States, that they would pick up some really nasty bugs, whether it was parasites, bacteria. And when you're traveling, especially, you know, you're outside your house, you're exposed to all kinds of germs, more particularly in the last 20-30 years. And I was also in the Air Force and the medics. I saw soldiers come back from Vietnam, and they had these very exotic viruses that no one knew what they were. They would come back jaundiced, and, you know, literally had to quarantine them because we didn't know what we were dealing with. So the problem today is that you have all these new viruses developing. I'm down here in Florida, and several years ago they had the Zika virus. It wasn't natural to our environment. Came from Brazil. People came up into Florida and Miami, and the mosquitoes bit these people, and it started spreading. Now it's across the United States, and it's tens and tens of thousands of cases. So there's all things we're exposed to, and we're in high-risk environments every day because you don't know who's around you, where they're coming from, what they're bringing in. I mean, how do you get malaria in New York City? They've had cases in the city because people come from countries that have it, and they bring it up here, and you find it in these infectious settings in hospitals. So the first step is, and you've covered it really well as far as building the immune system, but you also need to be aware of your environment and also have a protective strategy or techniques that are useful to protect yourself from being exposed and also contracting all kinds of bugs that are potentially in your environment. Aside from the other particles that are in the environment, we have smoke, pollen, molds, perfumes, dust. These are allergens are in the environment everywhere you go, whether you're in an airplane, you're in a car, you're driving down the road, you're traveling, you're in theater, you're in an elevator. These are all points of exposure where you can come in contact with respirable particles that can be either infectious or non-infectious, but they can harm your health. So being aware of it is first, then having a strategy and having something with you that you can take anywhere you go. You know, I mean, obviously, for air cleaning, you can't walk around with a big air filter. That's not practical. You know, most air filters, even a small one, are going to weigh 5, 10, 15 pounds. An effective one could be 30, 40 pounds. Plus, you need something, whether you're at your desk, in an office, for example. A lot of people work in offices where they have copy machines, where they're producing gaseous odors. There are germs floating around the building. You're in closed environments. Any kind of contaminant can get into your breathing space. So particularly today, we're concerned about the viruses because you're hearing it on the news. You know, you also have flu season, which, of course, is as lethal or more lethal than a coronavirus. But my concern here is that this particular virus, when it infects somebody and you don't have symptoms, you can be a carrier and you can affect other people even though you're asymptomatic. Whereas with, say, the flu, you're usually sneezing or coughing, you have some symptoms, and then you're aerosoling the germs into the environment and they discharge. And the dangerous thing is that viruses can travel not just a few feet, but they can travel throughout a building. They've done the studies with SARS, and I was involved with this SARS epidemic when they got it up in Canada. The hospitals, the workers, the healthcare workers, even after the SARS was wiped out and they didn't have any patients in the building, these viral particles, they dry up and they can float around the environment. They can float in the air ducts, and hospital care workers were infected with SARS after patients were gone from the hospital months later. And this is a little bit concerning, obviously, because, you know, you can say there's an epidemic now where it's going to spread, but even when it's over, you have to be aware that there's still viral particles floating around in your environment that you have to be concerned about. So the mini-ionic, the mini-mate, is a personal air protective device. And like you mentioned, it's very portable, it's very small. This is the latest generation, and the studies that have been done that have tested this, they've shown, for example, the one study, evaluation of ionic air purifiers, reducing aerosol exposure in confined indoor spaces by Dr. Grinspun, Manilis et al. This was done for at the Center for Health-Related Aerosol Studies. It was published in Indoor Air in 2005. And what it shows is that when you wear this particular device, and it's very crucial that you understand that it's the amount of ions produced. The more ions that you produce, the more unipolar ions you produce, the higher the concentration, the more effective the device. So there was a lot of devices out there that were early stages that just didn't produce the amount of ions, and they really weren't that effective. So this particular device, the mini-ionic, mini-mate, has been shown in this one study. The removal efficiency of this more powerful purifier reduces airborne or aerosol particles in your breathing space, that's about in a foot and a half radius, 50% after 15 minutes, and almost 100% after 1.5 hours of continuous operation. This is under calm air conditions. So if you're in an office or a confined space on a plane, anywhere, within 15 minutes, you're reducing the aerosol particles in your breathing space by 50%. So what are aerosol particles? Anything that's a particulate, it could be a virus, a bacteria, it could be a dust particle. The mini-ionic, mini-mate will reduce the particles by 50% in 15 minutes. So if you're stationary, you're on a 2-hour flight or 3-hour flight, you wear this continuously, your breathing space is protected from particles that you're not breathing in. That's incredibly important. Now, quite a few years ago, they had a woman that traveled on a plane. She had tuberculosis. She was infective, and she was sneezing and coughing on the plane, and a lot of people got infected. So even if you're sitting several rows away in the plane, these viruses and particles circulate around the plane. It's a closed environment. And they've shown that the filters in planes are not effective against reducing viruses significantly. So generally on a plane, they don't take the filters out and clean them. They don't clean the air. You go on a plane after people have been on it, you go, these planes will be in operation continuously. You're going to have a lot of infected particles. Well, if I have to fly, I bring a kit with me. So I take the mini-ionic, I take disinfection wipes, plastic latex gloves, and I wipe the seats down. I always wear the mini-ionic when I travel in the airport and through the plane. I wear it throughout the flight. If I have to go to the bathroom, I wipe everything down because they're radioactive in there. You know, they're just filthy, and they're loaded with germs. So you can contract an infection just flying on a plane. Putting the seat down, the table down, and eating with that, there's a lot of germs. So you have to be aware that you're always exposed to germs, and particularly in the air. The only method to protect yourself is either wear a mask, and those masks are not available right now, the good ones. And if you have a mask there, either wear a mask, and those masks are not available right now, the good ones. And if you have a mask, they're really not that effective because of particle penetration. Viruses will penetrate most masks up to an N95 or better, and they leak around the side. So if you wear the mini mate, you have a constant level of protection that you don't have to worry about wearing a mask. If you have a mask, it's better because they've done studies where people wear the mask and the mini mate, and you're really 100% protected from airborne particles if you have a decent mask, and N95 or better. So these are the strategies you need to be using right now. You can't wait because what's happening, and this has happened in previous flu epidemics, the SARS epidemic, everybody panics. They're grabbing all the masks off the shelves. They don't have any, you know, these devices are going to be gone, and you won't have the level of protection where you need it. So the point is you need to do something right now, and this is a device that I would recommend having as part of a protection package. And you mentioned a lot of other strategies. Of course, building your immune system is important. So this is the only effective way you can really reduce particles in your breathing space compared to anything else that's out there. There's no other device that I've seen that can generate the level of ions. So this device produces 120 trillion ions per second. Just think about that, 120 trillion ions per second. That's incredible. That's a stream of unipolar ions that will saturate the airspace around your breathing space. It will precipitate out or agglomerate particles, including bacteria and viruses. And one of the studies they did here in the University of Cincinnati is that they tested the device against E. coli and Pseudomonas fluorescens, which are basically test organisms that they use as what they call surrogate test bacteria. So when you test the bacteria, and they tested also small salt particles at 0.3 microns to 3 microns, and the data suggested that the ionic air purifier was particularly efficient in reducing aerosol exposure in the breathing space when used inside confined spaces. That means you're sitting at a desk, you're in a plane, you're in a confined space, a cabin, aircraft cabin, a bathroom, or small residential rooms or offices. So when you're sitting there and you're generating that level of ions, the particles are going to migrate out of your airspace, your breathing space, and deposit on surfaces. Now, of course, you don't want to touch the surfaces because then you could pick it up by touching it, and you have to periodically clean these surfaces. But the point is you have an effective, efficient device that you can wear all the time. It's very simple. It doesn't affect you in any way as far as causing any problems. It fits in your pocket. It covers a radius of 1 to 2 feet. You have a lithium battery, and I would suggest also getting some extra batteries. But it can be taken anywhere, and it's very, very portable. And this is really a unique device.
Good. I appreciate very much what you're sharing with us. And let me just mention that, unlike in the past, we are now seeing three things happen with WBAI, Michael, and I think you can confirm this. First, we've had, and I want to thank Linda Perry specifically because it was through her.
Gary, you still with us? We seem to maybe have lost your connection. We'll reestablish our connection right away with Gary. Now, let me take this moment to ask for your support. Now, at the $125 level, $125, we'll send you this as a thank you gift to you for supporting WBAI. That is the Mini Mate Air Purifier. The Mini Mate Air Purifier. Gary has been talking about it and the necessity of protecting and cleaning the surfaces all around your environment, not just the area in the bathroom, but everything else around you. It is $125. The call number is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. Please don't sleep on this. Please don't wait on this. And as I'm listening to you talk about this, Gary, you are preaching, as far as I'm concerned, you are preaching to the choir, because I do some of these practices myself each and every day with isopropyl alcohol. I'm touching different computers and laptops and certain things. So I'm very careful about that as much as I can. Phones where different people are using them. It's 516-620-3602. The Mini Mate Air Purifier. That's what you're asking for today. And we're offering that to you as a thank you gift during this membership and fundraising drive. So let us hear from you now. Gary, we'll throw it back to you. And our Dr. Spicer is still on the line with us as well. Gary?
Yes, thank you, Michael. By the way, Michael, I want you to confirm this, but I was just informed today that WBAI has gained 20,000 new listeners in the last 12 months. And if that indeed is the case, then I want to thank Linda Perry for having the courage to make programs that are more in alignment with what the listeners want. Because if you give people what they want and need, you'll get an audience, even by word of mouth.
Yeah, it's a difficult task to perform, being a program director at a Pacifica station, certainly at WBAI. And we appreciate all of the support that we are getting from new listeners that are tuning in now. Tuning in to some of the programs that have been established for years and years, such as yours, and some of the newer programs that are coming into our space, into our orbit. The collaboration that we're doing with other radio stations, particularly PFW, it's a wonderful thing to see. We have some struggles ahead of us, and I think we'll get there. And this is one of the ways I have been fundraising and helping support this program since I started here in 1998. And those of you who have been listening far longer than that have been supporting the Gary Null Show. So we're asking you to step forward and support us. Now, make that call right now. We're standing by. You're getting all of this information commercially free. We don't stop to do anything else but bring you the information. And that's what Gary is doing. That's what his guest is here doing. But we need to hear from you. That is the only way we're going to be able to continue to bring you this information without without selling you some kind of bath soap or stockings or automobiles or something like that. We come to you and ask for this support, and you are doing so right now. And I appreciate that. I really, really do. And it's very simple. It's very quick. It takes you all of 3 minutes to make the call in support of WBAI. 516-620-3602. Mini Mate Air Purifiers. Go ahead, Gary.
You're not only getting the Mini Mate Air Purifier, which is limited, and unfortunately it's limited, but it's limited. We could only get 100 right now. And just so everyone knows, I don't make one penny off any of this. Now, some skeptics, and these are just bitter, angry people, want to believe, oh, yeah, Gary's
fine. Yes, no. Yes.
No, you can ask Bertold, you can ask Andrea Katz, you can ask Linda Perry. Bertold paid directly to the manufacturer.
Yes, he did.
So that I have nothing to do with that. I'm merely the messenger bringing you what I believe is the best possible way to prevent all forms of unwanted material going into your body. And therefore, if you're older, you're going to be more challenged, because we're finding that people who are succumbing to pneumonia and the common cold and other viruses are older people. Very young and very old, because their immune system is not fully developed when they're younger. The immune system is frequently compromised when they're older. So, but you're also getting my documentary on ozone.
That's right.
Because if anybody ever came, and thousands of patients came to the Tri-State Healing Center from 1987 till 2000, then you know that I work with everyone who had all forms of illnesses and help them the best I could with protocols and our medical staff. We had a full medical staff, board certified physicians, top nurses, and Mitch Proppen, the chiropractor. We had Dr. Omar Gadol, the holistic dentist. We had acupuncturists, colonic therapists. We had everyone there. It was a wonderful experience. We saved lives by the thousands. I personally paid for the treatment of over 1,200 persons with full-blown AIDS. And so we are used to working with people, and we educate people. No one ever just gets a protocol. They get a whole education in what you can do to prevent a condition, whether it's diabetes or cancer. So right now, today, we take a look at the world we're living in, And right now, depending upon where you live, you have unpredictable outcomes, meaning we shouldn't panic. We shouldn't hit the, you know, emergency alarm, but we should realize that in China, we're not getting the full truth. I have one report that I believe is credible that shows over 1.5 million Chinese infected and over 50,000 dead. Don't rely upon the Chinese to tell you the truth. Mind you, these are the same people who have over 1 million Uyghurs, a whole culture of people in internment camps, and they harvest organs, and they have a whole interned Muslim population. So there's a whole lot of things that I'm not happy with about them and their government. So that same government is going to lie. And then we have other countries like Japan that still has not dealt with Fukushima, as if it doesn't exist, and it does, the worst environmental catastrophe in the world for the last 8 years. And they mishandled this completely, totally. They really screwed up and then tried to cover up. So when you have a virus out there and it's spreading and they didn't quarantine people, and America, as dumb as we could be, we allowed known infected people from that cruise ship to go from the cruise ship onto that plane where there were non-infected people.